Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carroll saying hello and welcome you to the latest Bantercast, the weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of public talks and events. At Banter, we put on events in spaces and venues of all shapes and sizes up and down the country, invite a range of interesting people to come along, and they tell us stories, talk about their lives and discuss various topics and themes. We record what happens in the room and then we podcast the results. Over the last few years, we've been impressed as the Food Cloud social enterprise has made great strides in helping supermarkets, producers and farmers redistribute surplus food to charities. It was a great pleasure to welcome Food Cloud's co-founder, Evine O'Brien, to the Sure Shots Surf Festival in the Modlin and Sligo the other month to hear more about this venture and what their future plans are. Hi folks, welcome along to the first of today's banter sessions here at the Modlin Sligo. Hi to everyone watching on Facebook Live as well. We talked to kind of four or five very interesting people yesterday, and today we've got four equally bright people and interesting stories to hear, and we're joined this morning by Evine O'Brien from Food Cloud. Welcome along to Banter.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's start with you. Before we kind of go on to, I suppose, kind of talking about Food Cloud, let's start with your own background. I mean, when you were growing up in Port Dumna, I mean, what was the food situation like there? I mean, were you one of these kind of families that like valued food? Were you a foodie family?
I suppose we were, but didn't realise it at the time in terms of cooking everything from scratch, no tins, no ready meals. But for us, that was just, you know, I think we were like a lot of families back in the 80s and 90s. So, like, it was a foodie family. My parents are both into it. My dad is a vet, so it was kind of an agricultural background. But it was more, it's also about the community. It was a small community. Everybody was into camogie or rugby or whatever was going on in the town. Everyone got involved. So it was a mixture of a very community upbringing, you know, with a focus on agriculture and food. And also my mum was a bit of an environmentalist before her time. So there was kind of that mix of social conscience was fairly strong, even though at the time it was just a natural thing. It wasn't a conscious thing.
Okay, so when you were in school then, I mean, did you have a very clear path about what you wanted to do? I mean, your first job was in the job that you mentioned in kind of like, you know, all the interviews is in investment banking in London. Was that kind of like, I'm trying to imagine, was that what you wanted to be when you're back in Port Dumna?
Yeah, not really. I think, well, I don't think most teenagers really know what they want to do. I had no idea really, but I suppose when it came up to the Leaving Cert, I was really into food, so it was actually a toss, and really into sport, and then I was kind of good with numbers and things, so it was a toss-up between, I think, dietetics, physio, and there was a law and accounting course in UL that was pretty good for a good grounding, and I thought, I did always have that thing about making a difference, and I thought if I got some kind of good grounded background in something, it might help me in the future if I wanted to diversify or whatever. So it was more a decision around doing something broad because I had no idea what I wanted to do rather than having a clear path. So that degree has a co-op placement in it. So I suppose I fell into investment banking because I got a spot working for an investment bank in London for 9 months during my course. And the money was good and I was in London and it was all very exciting. So I got a placement from that, but they also agreed that I didn't have to go straight back. I said, if I deferred it for a year and went traveling, would you hold my job? And this was pre-recession. So basically, I went back to college with a job secured in an investment bank and able to take a year off. So it was a mixture of things that led to working in an investment bank and really.
Yeah. Did you like Limerick?
Yeah, I loved it. I haven't been back that much loads since, but in terms of a college, it was really brilliant. The sports facilities are brilliant. You're outside in a little bubble, so all your neighbours are students. You don't see anybody over or under, like, 20s. So it's total bubble. It was brilliant, brilliant crack. Totally recommend it. Probably more on the socialising than the study or giving anything back to the community, but right. There's a time for everything.
Exactly. Do you spend much time in the stables?
I did. Yeah. And the lodge and the hurlers and whatever else. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, right. So then, like, I mean, let's fast forward into kind of like investment banking in London, you know? I mean, that when someone says you're an investment banker, there's certain kind of like, I suppose, the images come to mind, you know? There are certain ideas we see from TV programs or film programs, you know? How did you find the work?
Like, I remember my first placement there, the only job work experience I had was waitressing. And I'd never, like, even knew how to send a proper email, you know. It was a total baptism of fire where it was all pressure, pressure, pressure. And when I went on a placement, it was 2005, so it was really good times. So everybody worked hard and played hard, and it was really fun, but it was very, very stressful in terms of the work. But I did enjoy it, and then when I went back, I went on this graduate program, and what it was, J.P. Morgan is the bank, so it was a big American.
Oh, right. So like, I mean, that's kind of like, I mean, one of those kind of masters of the universe type banks.
Yeah, like that's huge.
Jamie Dimon, isn't it?
Jamie Dimon. Yeah. So like, it's a huge investment bank, and they have a really structured graduate program, and really good training and all that kind of stuff. So when I went back, it was like a rotation. So my first rotation was grand. It was fairly standard, and it wasn't that stressful. And then I spotted around the corner that there was a group that were doing environmental and social risk management, and I'd never heard of it before, so I got chatting to them, and basically they were looking at the non-financial risks of big transactions, so like mining companies in Africa, dams, like anything that was, you know, had environmental impacts. And they were a very small team, 3 people covering the whole of JP Morgan. So I said, wouldn't it be great if I got into that group for my second rotation? They had no junior people, so I managed to muscle my way in, and that's where I think I was able to match, I suppose, the kind of accountancy and law bit that I did, and then that environmental and social part. And it was really brilliant in terms of the work, like, but it was depressing as well, because I was going out to quarries in Turkey or the copper mines in Zambia and trying to convince, you know, the bankers that, you know, if the mining company shoots their workers, that's probably needs to be disclosed. So that was it was a battle between what was actually happening on the ground and what was disclosed to potential investors.
Yeah.
So it was really, really interesting in terms of matching, you know, you wouldn't think of that job in an investment bank.
No, you wouldn't. But like, as you're saying that, I'm kind of thinking that there's probably a lot of investors and probably some institutional investors as well who would be looking at kind of the ethics, who would be looking kind of like everything from greenwashing to how they treat their staff.
Yeah. So it was basically like when I started, it was just a team of 3. And now, like, I'm still friends with the guys there, and it's a team that spread across London and Washington. So it was only starting out and I was there, but it was more about ethical investing. And, you know, if you are investing in a copper mine in a water scarce region, you should have a water permit, or you should have plans in place to, you know, make sure the community aren't left without water because of the mine or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So it is actually becoming much more of a thing that investors are looking for. So that's really promising. At the time, it was a little bit depressing that you'd write up big memos and you'd spend months on a project, and then, you know, it would get watered down as a line in the prospectus that there are some HR issues here, but they will be resolved over time. but it is definitely hopeful, but it's still early days.
Like the fact that kind of like that all that work by that small unit was distilled down to one line, did that kind of show that like the other people in JP Morgan didn't really understand what was going on and didn't really want to understand?
Yeah, I think, and it's the same thing like years later in Food Cloud, it's trying to quantify environmental and social issues into the bottom line. So like, you know, if they don't have a water permit, how much is it going to cost them to fix it? And if it's not material in the overall scheme of things, well, then it's not important.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, I suppose the reality of the world we live in is that, you know, environmental and social issues need to have some kind of quantification if you're trying to bring about change.
Yeah, okay. So let's move on to another change then, which is when you decide to do a maths in Trinity.
Yeah, so I was working in London in environmental and social risk management, so came off the graduate program, was really enjoying it there, but realized that we were like advising people like Gazprom on their energy, and people were like, oh, and are you some kind of environmental engineer? And I was like, I did law and accounting in UL. And they were like, where is that? So I decided that, you know, this is definitely an area I want to go, you know, be in. So I came back to Ireland to do my master's. There was also, I did have this feeling, I didn't really love working for an American investment bank in 2012, you know, where I felt guilty a little bit about that. And also I didn't want to be one of those statistics around, you're reading about all these Irish people, you know, who'd loads of ideas and bright and everything, and they're gone out of the country. So I didn't really want to be a statistic. So I decided to move home to do it. And also in between, I'd gone traveling and done to South America and done like volunteer work, and realized from that actually the biggest impact you can make is in an environment that you know. So I felt like we were doing after schools clubs in Buenos Aires, and we were getting more out of it than the poor kids. So I thought, if you really do want to make a difference, I felt you could. You were more powerful doing it in where you understand the landscape and you can really make things happen. So there was a couple of motivations to come back to do the master's. Not being totally happy with banking, wanting to do something different, and obviously realizing that environmental areas was where I wanted to go.
What you said there is very interesting, because I mean, you said, like, you know, you kind of were feeling, you're in London, you're kind of looking at what's going on back home. You said, I can make a difference back there. Do you think, you know, that, like, I mean, of the people who've left in the last 10 years, that the majority of them feel the same way?
Like, out of my friend group that moved over, most of them are starting to trickle back now. Sometimes it's family reasons, but sometimes, and some have stayed, obviously. Sometimes it's family reasons, sometimes it is because they want to make their impact at home. It depends, really. It's a very personal thing. Yeah. But, you know, the group that I hung out with in kind of 2012, 2013, most are kind of starting to trickle back now.
Okay, so you're back in Trinity, then you're doing your master's, and then there's a kind of eureka moment.
Yeah, so while I was in London, there was loads of stuff going on around food waste and food redistribution. So there was an organization called Food Cycle that has cafes, and it makes surplus lunches for older people, and it's done by students, so it's really cool. And then there was Rubies in the Rubble, which makes jams and chutneys from surplus fruit and veg and all this cool stuff. But I was working long hours and reading about it on the tube on the way home rather than actually being able to get involved. So when I moved home, I thought, brilliant, I'll be doing a master's. I can volunteer with an organization that does something like this back in Dublin. And quickly realized that actually there wasn't anything happening.
And was there any particular reason why, you know, your interest was piqued by this idea of kind of food wastage? Was it something you see in South America, or was it something else?
I think it was the home. It was that I was obviously working in environment and sustainability and seeing how much food was part of that. You know, we all need to eat. If the, you know, if there's issues with water, if there's issues with air, if there's issues with soil, you know, we all need food to survive. So I think it was loving food from a young, you know, being really interested in food. I suppose realizing the issue of food waste, because I didn't realize that it was such a big deal, and that's what kind of piqued the interest, and seeing people do really fun things to solve it in a very practical grassroots way.
I mean, the numbers are crazy. It's something like 30% of all food produced, it goes to waste.
Yeah, so that's what the UN said. One of the issues is that nobody has proper data, but the estimates are 30% of food produced. So that's very hard to kind of picture, but the UN say if you put China, Mongolia, and Kazakhstan all together to grow food that's never actually eaten every year, so that's the landmass that's used. And water consumption and resources and energy and all that stuff as well. So it's fairly fairly stark.
It's huge, because I mean, when you said that figure, I was going by Tesco this morning, I need to get a banana, so I went in, and that figure was in my head, and then I realized, okay, so all the food here in Tesco, put all the Tescos together, that's only 2/3 of the world's production.
Yeah.
You know, like, I was just kind of, it's just staggering to realize that then how much is actually gone.
Yeah. And I suppose it's wasted at every step of the supply chain, and because the food system is so complex, it's very hard to get a sense of what's happening and where. So it's a huge problem, and it's in one of the UN Sustainable Development Goals now that it has to be reduced in order to help us to feed 9 billion people by you know, 2025 or whenever. So it's been put forward as a high priority action, and hopefully that'll trickle down then into incentives and support for organisations like ourselves.
Okay, so like, I mean, you're saying ourselves there. So like, I mean, talk to us about like, I mean, how Food Cloud came together and where it came together.
Yeah, so there was nothing happening in Dublin. There was a lot happening in the UK, and there's actually quite a bit happening in internationally around this whole idea of surplus food redistribution. I went to a social enterprise event in Trinity in about February 2012, and I pitched this idea, and it was actually the cafe, it was Food Cycle. I said, you know, if we got together and did a pop-up event with surplus food students in the canteen on a Sunday or something. And Iselt Ward, who's the co-founder of Food Cloud, was actually at that event as well. So she said she'd get involved. So after lots of work and looking at the issue, we decided that actually the pop-up cafe would have been good, but it would have been very token. So we realized that while there was internationally big food kind of redistribution banks, there was like supermarkets across the world and across the country where every day your Tesco store was throwing out food, and then you'd walk down the road and you'd see St. Vincent de Paul raising money for their after schools club to buy food for the kids that go there. So we were really kind of motivated by the idea of bringing businesses and charities within communities together to solve the problems of food waste and food poverty at a very local level. So we were doing it under this kind of college project, which is called Enactus. It's a social enterprise organization. And we started by calling farmers markets in Dublin. So Glasnevin Farmers Market said, okay, we do have some on a Saturday afternoon, not loads, but we have like good quality sausages and some bread and probably two boxes full. So we said, brilliant, we'll try it. So we literally called the charities in Glasnevin and said, would you be interested? And one or two of them said, yeah, although first they were like, free food, what's the catch? So we just literally linked them up. And at the time we had seen like a website in the UK in London, which had, you know, you could pop up if you were a food business interested in donating in a charity. But what we found was that wasn't really interactive. And it's like those websites that they should work, but they need everybody to get involved to make them work. So we actually ended up picking up the donation ourselves and dropping it off, even though that wasn't the idea. But it got the whole thing going, and we just thought, you know, if that was the June bank holiday weekend of 2012, and we thought, if that's one farmer's market in one part of Dublin, can you imagine what's out there? So I did my thesis that summer on food redistribution, and use it as an excuse to go over to the UK to get loads of case studies, talk to the powers that be in Ireland, and that basically formed the basis of kind of like a feasibility study.
Yep.
I want to kind of go to, there's one thing in particular that, like, just reading the research on Food Cloud that struck me, and like, again, this is probably beyond farmers markets, probably dealing with supermarkets, and that's the kind of like, I mean, the importance and the sort of like influence of waste disposal legislation, waste disposal regulations on what you're doing as well, how you kind of can use that to your advantage.
Yeah, so I think, you know, initially we weren't really thinking about that. It's funny that you asked that, because now, kind of 3 years on, we're actually working on our strategy and looking at policy and legislation, whereas we just wanted to do something, and we didn't really want to get too bogged down in the policies and government advocacy and that kind of thing, because that just takes so long. So we just wanted to actually get going. So now we are looking at that in terms of incentivizing prevention first, and then the next step down would be people. The next step down would be animals, and then anaerobic digestion and bioenergy. And in America, actually, they have what's called the food waste hierarchy. So it's kind of like the reuse, reuse, recycle.
Yeah.
And like, what we'd like the government to be doing is obviously incentivizing prevention first, then incentivizing donation and other markets to get food to people, and then following that. So it is unfortunate, like, waste disposal costs are a huge cost to the food industry, but they're kind of recognized as just a cost of doing business now. So they don't really, they're not a lever necessarily for driving huge change, because it's just, that's what it's been like for years. So they just have waste as a line in the financials, and they're pretty comfortable with it. So like that's kind of an interesting one that we can start to look at now, right, that we're more established.
I suppose we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves in terms of narrative. Like, I mean, does yourself use it back in the last 11 food market,
yeah,
doing it by hand. At what stage did she kind of realize then that she had to kind of like go for tech in order to like get, stop the two of you going from food market with boxes of food?
Yeah. Like we had seen actually another startup in Chicago was using an app and to get this working. So we got in touch with them. They said, here, use ours and just try it. So what we realized was while we were delighted with ourselves in Glasnevin, that to do this at scale, it needed technology. So we started working with these guys in Chicago just to get an MVP up and running. And when we did that, It's a Bagel came on. And they trialed it and we failed. So we got one of our friends to pick up that donation and drop it off at a charity. And we had to go back to the drawing board then and say, right, this could work, but really we had to go back to the charities and say, what food would you actually collect? What food do you want? Because what happened was It's a Bagel gave like soup, and that was fine, and it was perfectly delicious and really good soup, but charities weren't willing to drive like across town to pick up two containers of soup. So we actually had to go back to the drawing board, interview loads of businesses, loads of charities, and what we realized was that the charities would be willing to engage, but that they really wanted food that they would be buying. So then we realized it's actually retailers. It's not necessarily farmers markets or cafes and bakeries. It's like, you know, Tesco and Aldi and Lidl, yeah, and where they were doing their normal shopping. So Tesco actually came on board in October 2013.
Tesco came on board really fast. That was something I kind of noticed this morning. And like, you know, and like, we all know Tesco is this massive kind of like, you know, conglomerate, you know, and they're in many ways kind of seeing the bad guys in an awful lot of food producers. But like, I was quite surprised that they came on board so quickly. Do you make a compelling case, or was this kind of something that's part of their kind of like corporate social responsibility?
First, it is part of their social responsibility. It was one of their three big objectives. So that was really handy for us, and we met their community manager at an event in Dublin and said, look, we'd really want to do this, and it's part of one of your three global sustainability priority areas. So what happened was they said, look, try it in one store. And then when it kind of worked, they said, okay, try it in 10 stores in inner city Dublin. And at that stage, it was working. Now, there was a lot of bread at the start, like lots of bread, and a lot of charities that were saying, look, we really want to support you, but enough of the bread already. So like we went to charities and they just had freezers, loads of breads, and they were like, we really want to make this work for you, but we have our freezers are stocked with petty pans.
Yeah.
So
give the breads to seagulls.
Yeah, I know. So Tesco came on board really, really early, and they really grabbed it then because it fit with their sustainability initiatives. So that was our big break as well. So I think like it was myself and Isselt, we were in an incubator kind of startup accelerator in Dublin. I had actually given up my job at that stage, and Isselt had finished university. So we were full time at it, the two of us.
Right. Which incubator was it?
The NDRC's launch pad.
Oh, we launched pad, yeah.
Okay, yeah, right, yeah, yeah. So we that's got
up,
into
that's
that.
Up, sorry for the question. That's up in Guinness. In the Liberties, yeah.
Yeah, and it's basically 12 weeks where you've got kind of a bit of a stipend, you've got office space, and you're surrounded by others kind of at the same level as you are, with mentors, and you kind of refine your business plan or whatever. So that was brilliant because it gave me the confidence to just quit my job, and it gave us a focus for the 12 weeks, so it was very disciplined. But yeah, Tesco came on board. We were making it work with the 10 or 11 stores across around Dublin. And
so those 211 stores, they were kind of like in North Inner City, weren't they? So
yeah,
that was kind of like Talbot Street.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like what the interesting thing is now, as we've grown, we realise those are actually the trickiest stores. The big, huge extra stores are like the best ones to, they have the right amount
the process,
of food,
yeah,
for the charities and all that kind of stuff. They close earlier. So yeah, we started working with one, we went to 11, and then after Christmas, we kind of got taken in to present, and they said, okay, we want it across Ireland. in April. So then
a serious scale.
Yeah. So we had gone, and it was just the two of us at the time. So we started to build the team, and we started to expand across Ireland. And we had to invest in the technology. The Chicago guys, their technology worked, but not at scale.
Yeah.
So we invested in the technology. We built a bit of a team, and we basically went on this kind of mad road trip. Wherever there was a Tesco in Ireland, we were bringing charities to see what they get involved, like from Sligo to New Ross to, like, I think as far west as Newcastle West.
Okay, so let's the kind of purpose of kind of, like, I suppose, explain things exactly. So you've got this app, right?
Mm-hmm.
So is this app to be used by the retailer or the charity or both? Back then, I know things have kind of, like, changed in the meantime.
Yeah, so, like, essentially, if you're a store manager in Talbot Street, you've got surplus food, you close at a certain time every day, you upload details of what food you have available for donation. That generates a text message, and it goes out to the charities in the area, and they can text back and say, I'll take it. So that means that it links the charity and the business, but also there's traceability. So you know, okay, Salvation Army picked up from Talbot Street on that night, and this is the food they collected. So you're able to monitor your impact for us to see, are we actually making any difference here? And you're also, from a food safety perspective, it's very important. So as we evolved, we realized that in order to suit the charities, they needed certain nights. So, like, St. Vincent de Paul in Drogheda said, we'll 100% collect on a Monday night, but we will not collect, like, on Tuesday to Sunday, because we don't meet on them. So we were able then to invest in the technology where when Drogheda's Tesco posts on a Monday, it goes directly to St. Vincent de Paul. So it still is the same process.
It's targeted.
But it's targeted.
Yeah.
So, and then we've evolved that over time. So we have a designated time for Tesco stores to donate and a designated time for collection. So it's really process driven. Whereas at the start we said, oh, if they just put up the donation, and we were surprised when people didn't want it. But it was 11 o'clock on a Saturday night.
Yeah.
Like, who's going to go and collect it?
Exactly.
So we have, it's really, really process driven now. So we expanded across Ireland with Tesco. Then Aldi came on board, and we have expanded with them as well across Ireland. So we're working with about 300 retail stores and about 350 charities across the country. Then the next piece of that was that Tesco said, okay, would you help us bring this into the UK? So in 2014, we started to expand into the UK, and now there's about 900 to 1,000 stores are donating in the UK. So it's kind of gone from, you know, one store in October 2013 to every evening there's about 1,500 donations happening, and it's all monitored from Dublin. And, you know, we just check in to make sure, okay, if the charity doesn't text back, we follow up. So we're essentially kind of the intermediaries between the retailers and the charity sector.
Okay, so that's the retail sector then.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, you're in the 2 year, probably kind of going, like, great, we've got that kind of licked. At what stage did you realise then that, hang on a second, there's a food wastage problem to be kind of addressed in terms of, like, I mean, producers, farmers as well?
Yeah, so, like, as I said, food redistribution as a concept is, like, you know, 30 or 40 years old in the US. They had their first kind of food redistribution warehouse in the 70s in Arizona, but in Ireland we didn't have anything. So we actually started the other way around compared to other countries, where we didn't have this kind of large scale food redistribution. We started with retail, and other countries had been like, retail is too difficult, we're not even going to look at it. So that concept of redistributing from producers, manufacturers and farmers was well established. So we started working on that then with a pilot in Cork. So we set up a warehouse in Cork where we were taking large volumes of surplus product. So that would be like, I'll give you some examples. Lakeland Dairies would be one of our donors. They had a couple of weeks ago donated 11 pallets of mint chocolate chip ice cream, where the mint chocolate chips hadn't dispersed properly across the batch. So, like, some of the ice cream was really chocolate chippy and some had no chocolate chips, but it was still all perfect. Or short dated product, you know, we got 26 pallets of fruit and nuts, and it was just that they had 3 weeks left to go on them. So there's a lot of food wasted earlier in the supply chain. So we started with the pilot in Cork. and then got buy-in from Tesco again, Musgrave Group, and loads of others, because they really needed a solution to this. And last year set up two further hubs, one in Dublin and one in Galway. So Iselt is now managing kind of the retail and the technology, and I'm managing the warehouse level logistics.
Okay. So, like, I mean, you said there, like, you've got the kind of warehouses in kind of, I think it's Dublin, Cork, and Galway.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, so what's the cost implications there? I mean, I'm curious about that as well. I mean, yeah. Are you suddenly in a situation where, like, I mean, you've got like large rental costs now?
Yeah. So to run the warehouse food cloud hubs, it's 1.2 million per year across for the three hubs. So we have a couple of revenue streams. We do charge the charities a contribution fee for the food from the hubs, and it's mostly really, really high value product. You know, so we charge them. It works out about 10% of the retail value, so it's a huge discount, but it just helps us generate operating income. We also run a labour activation scheme, so with the Department of Social Protection, 70% of the staff that we have in the hubs would have been in receipt of benefits before they joined. So that gives us, every job we create, we get it part funded from the government, and it fits in with our overall ethos as well. And then we run a European food aid programme, which is a separate issue altogether, and that helps us generate revenue as well. And then we do fundraising, but not kind of general public, more from awards and grants and corporates rather than, you know, kind of public fundraising.
I'm curious about, like, I mean, the food from the hubs. Is that food then going, are the charities then using that for kind of run food banks? Is that what they're using it for?
So on the hub side and on the food cloud side, we've charities like St. Vincent de Paul's around the country. They would be giving hampers out to families that need it, right through to Peter McVerry Trust that's doing a full meal or Meals on Wheels services. So we've a range of charities, and they're all using food in different ways. Like, so it doesn't, you know, we've got after schools clubs, we've got drug rehabilitations centres, you've got Meals on Wheels, you've got elderly services. So it's kind of agnostic as to what kind of charities we work with. If, as part of their service, they provide food, then we work with them. Mm. So it really is the whole spectrum of your local very small charity right through to your professional charity.
All right, so okay, that's retailers. You talked about Tesco, Aldi, or the supermarkets. You talked about producers with Lakeland Dairies. What about, like, mean farmers then? I mean, we were talking about this before we started.
Yeah. So one of the areas that's a bit of an unknown in food waste is how much is actually wasted at farm level.
Talk a little bit about that kind of even, because it's like, you're trying to think, like, farmers are producing kind of stuff. They're producing it basically to sell in many cases. Or, I mean, if they've got like EU subsidy, there's probably a limit on how much they can produce. So, like, I mean, what happens normally then with the food waste? Is it just not harvested?
Sometimes if, say, for example, like this year, cauliflowers were early. Last year it was really sunny, so potatoes were bigger than their, you know, the customer specifications. Broccolis were smaller the year before. So it just, like, it's nature. So it depends on the contracts.
It's funny, sorry to cross you, but when you say that, like, broccolis were smaller, potatoes were bigger, and I'm kind of, many people be kind of going, yeah, so what? But this comes back to kind of like in customer preference. Customers have a certain image in mind when they go into the supermarkets of what the ideal potato, what the ideal carrot, what the ideal apple has to look for.
And I suppose it's just evolved as, maybe we've kind of moved away from producing ourselves, or we're quite removed from the whole process. But what would happen would be farmers would grow, and then because of whatever reasons, they won't even bother harvest it. So they'll just plough it back into the land, which isn't the worst thing because it's full of nutrients, but it's not what it's intended. You know, that's not what the labour and water and fertiliser was used for. So there's been a kind of an evolution of what's called the gleaning network in the UK and the US recently. And basically it's like armies of volunteers going out to farms and harvesting by hand product, and then redistributing it through the likes of ourselves to charities. So it's something that we actually got a little bit of funding to look at this year, and we're going to, in quarter four, like the end of the year this year, we're hoping to do kind of four pilots in Ireland.
Yeah.
But really, we'd love to get better data on farm level, like how much food is actually wasted at farm level, because it's really an unknown in the whole area.
And like, I mean, who are the kind of people who give you something like that? Would it be the IFA, ICMSA?
Yeah, like the IFA we've been speaking to about putting, like, suggesting farmers that would be suitable. Green Organics have come on board. They would have very little because they're organic, but it's just to get the whole concept up and running. And there's another couple of apple orchards, and there's a couple of big farms in Wexford and one in Meads that are up for it, and we just need to kind of get that over the line to get that up and running.
Right. When you say up for it, I mean farmers probably would, like, you know, be seen in many sectors as quite kind of conservative, quite kind of traditional. But, like, you know, we also know there's kind of quite innovative stuff going on at kind of agricultural level countrywide. Have the farmers you've spoken to, have they got the concept? I mean, and how and in their head are they looking upon the fact that you're going to have people coming in gleaning the crops? Is this kind of like they're kind of going, that's a sale we're missing out on, or do they understand what the concept is?
So far. Some are really, really get it and want to get involved. But for others, I suppose it is letting people on your land. Is it an insurance risk? Is it a health and safety risk? All that kind of stuff. So it's our job to kind of remove those barriers and open the doors into the farm sector. And normally, once you've got kind of 3 or 4 pilots that have gone well, you know, you've got
documentation to show.
Yeah. So I think that's the way we want to approach it, is just get a couple under the belt, get the kind of health and safety and all that crossed off and managed, and then, you know, we can scale it, hopefully. So that's just kind of one element, one area that we're kind of looking at this year.
Right. So, like, has the word got back to the JP Morgan dudes in kind of London about what you're up to right now, and how do you think they assess it?
I'm still in touch with a lot of my old work colleagues, and some of them are still there, and I think people say that was a really weird transition, wasn't it, going from investment banker to setting up a social enterprise? But, like, within investment banking, I was in environmental and social area, so I don't think they're massively surprised. You know, and I think, like, a lot of people, like, it is good training. I know for a lot of people, the investment banks or big accountancy firms are kind of like the the death of, they're not considered very innovative, but it's actually great training if you do want to set up your own business. Like, the discipline around, you know, meeting deadlines, you know, being working under pressure, that kind of thing, is really, really good. So I would say, like, to anybody who is interested in setting up a business, it's really good training to actually go and work in one of those environments first, and then see how you and then use those skills, you know, to do whatever you want to do yourself.
Yeah. I mean, it's an amazing journey, and I'm curious about, like, what discoveries you've made yourself about yourself and your kind of, like, your own capabilities in terms of that transition, in terms of what you're doing, in terms of, like, setting up Food Cloud as well.
Yeah, like, I think there's loads of things. It's been such a journey. I don't think if I'd known all the kind of challenges and the heartache and the highs and the lows, I don't know, would I have gone so full-heartedly into it? Like, there's something lovely about having a salary at the end of every month. So I think I always thought, I'd love to set up a business. And now when somebody says it to me, I think, really think about it, because, you know, it's so nice to be able to go home on a Friday evening and, you know, and have your salary and all that. So it has been an amazing journey. We've been able to do incredible things. We've met, like, what I love about it is that, you know, I was working in investment banking, everyone was a banker, everyone was the same. Where I work now, and the people I work with, it's charities. It's like 65-year-old women doing amazing things in Cashel, County Tipperary, to, like, executives in Tesco, you know. So it's in terms of every day, it's amazing. In terms of the challenges, like, we've gone from a 2-people project that started in college, and now we've got 30 staff. You know, both sides of the business, it's about a €2 million turnover, which for us is crazy. And that's kind of, you know, it does keep you up at night in terms of making sure that everybody is paid and is okay, and, you know, you're taking other people's careers and lives into account. Building a team is hard, and especially, you know, we're kind of do-gooders, or we're trying to do the right thing, but ultimately we have to deliver. So, you know, if people aren't performing, they still have to be held accountable for that. And that was, you know, I went from managing an intern in JP Morgan to having a full team, and that has been really challenging.
It's kind of funny, because anyone who starts up a business, the one thing they have in common is they don't realize how much kind of hard work or how much kind of heartbreak can occur around HR practices of all things.
Yeah. So it is really, you know, and I suppose then you go home and you read all these leadership and management books about all these inspiring, amazing leaders, and you're like, oh God, I'm never going to be one of them. So, like, that's kind of, that. I find that is the hardest thing, I suppose.
Do you enjoy
communicating your ideas and not being crazy all the time with your ideas and people saying, well, I can't get into your head, so I don't really know what you want me to do. So that's the real, it's not just, I'm sure, like, being an entrepreneurial is probably not a great person to work for either. You know what I mean? Like, being a manager who's all these mad ideas is probably not the easiest, we're probably not the easiest people to work for either. You know what I mean? So that is a challenge, but we have a brilliant team. You know, so like Iselt is managing the retail and the technology side, scaling into the UK. Like, we just won the Waitrose contract in the UK as well. And then I have the hub side, and we have a brilliant team there as well. So it hasn't been, it's not really about us as two people anymore. It's becoming more about what this kind of organization or movement can do. And like, it's great that it's not about two girls who set up this social enterprise anymore. It's more about, you know, bigger, a bigger, more important, what I think is more important anyway. But yeah, I think in terms of challenges, scaling, building a team, the highs and lows, so not getting so emotionally involved in everything, and being able to switch off is really difficult, but hopefully it comes with time. I'm not there yet, though.
Okay, excellent. Listen, well, thank you very much for coming up to join us in Sligo. Big round of applause, please, Fionn. Thanks, Emil. That was great.
Thanks to Eveen for joining us in Sligo, and thanks to Aidan, Shane and Al at Sure Shots for the invitation and all their help and hospitality. The Bantercast series producer is Tanya White. Check out thisisbanter.com for news we're up to at Banter. Plus, you can also listen back there to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another Bantercast. Until then, goodbye and take care.